Later, Eve Billings hastily removed her stained apron and dabbed at a smudge of flour on her nose. She rinsed her hands and walked quickly to where the guides had their small gathering, putting on her best smile and patting back a stray strand of auburn hair. When the men looked up from the coffee they shared with two fierce-looking Injuns, she repressed a shudder.
Preacher, it would greatly please me if you would take supper with my children and myself this evening. There will be another guest. Captain Edward Drayling has graciously accepted an invitation.
Preacher rolled that around in his head for a minute.
Well, now, there's a couple of things I'd like to take up with him, he being the only officer in that outfit that seems to have a lick of sense. I'll thank you for the invite. I'll be pleased to be there. What time?
Oh, say an hour before sundown. I've made a dried apple pie.
You are a treasure, Miss Eve. I'll bring along a little jug to wet our whistles.
After Eve departed, Three Sleeps Norris and Antoine Revier couldn't contain themselves.
Well, I teach formal invites from the little lady.
You'd best look out. She's set to make you the rooster in her henyard.
Oh, I don't believe that for a minute. No, sir, not for a minute. She's only being friendly.
Last time when we all went, that was being friendly. Mark me, preacher. She has got her cap set on you!
Shit, not by a long shot. You wait and see. A gal's just being nice.
Preacher timed his arrival at Eve's wagon to coincide with that of Captain Drayling. Eve greeted them warmly, showed him to straight-back chairs she had dug out of her household goods, and had had Charlie dust to a suitable turn. Playing the good hostess, she accepted a very watered-down whiskey from Preacher. The mountain man and the dragoon officer took theirs straight and tall.
Are we far from where you are going?
Only a week or so, give or take a few days.
I must admit, I am grown quite weary of living in a wagon. Captain Drayling, what will it be like going on to the Oregon country?
I'm afraid I can't help you there. Army travel is quite different.
As I have observed, riding free and easy on a horse, living in a tent, it seems so romantic.
Believe me, Miss Eve, it is far from that. Even for us, accustomed to going on horseback, it took a week after leaving the steam packets to rid ourselves of saddle sores.
My, sir, the image that presents. Should I be scandalized? No, I think not.
As the evening progressed, Eve flirted with both of them outrageously. She secretly wanted to strike sparks of jealousy from Preacher. To all outward appearances, her plan failed miserably. Preacher was charming and gracious, and entertained all present with tall tales of his trapping years. When the time came to end the gathering, Charlie asked permission to accompany Preacher to his fireside. Once the boy had the mountain man out of earshot of his mother's wagon, he crooked an index finger to draw Preacher down to his level. Preacher hunkered down.
You'd best look out, Preacher. My mom's trying to kindle the fires of romance in your heart. I know, because I heard her telling Mrs. Honeycutt.
Well, shucks, son, I know that. Women been hatching such schemes since the first Eve kissed a snake.
But don't you just hate it? How can you abide a woman who'd sneak about and plot behind your back?
Well, no problem at all. Truth is, I sort of hanker after the affection of a pretty woman now and again. That ain't all bad, is it?
Girls ain't good for anything.
Now, how about you, son? Would you object to my being around your mama somewhat?
Oh, no, sir. Not at all. I'd like to have you around.
Well, then, don't let all of it fret you. Old Preacher can manage for himself right enough. Now, you better get on back. Night, Charlie.
Early the next morning, the dragoons prepared to move on. Tight-faced, Three Crows walking and five braves, one slightly wounded, came to Preacher.
If you would have us, we would come with you, help to scout. Maybe we'll find the ones who did this.
I don't know about that. You'd have to provide each for yourselves, and the army won't feed you. They won't pay you either. But I might find a few coppers, some silver you can rub together when this is over.
You would pay us?
You'd do a good job? Yeah, I sure will.
With that settled, the six Arapaho mounted the ponies they had managed to save and fanned out ahead of the column which was formed. They rode straight out of sight to the northwest. Preacher gave them half an hour, then he and his companions mounted, ready to set off. But not before Lieutenant Colonel Danvers came up to Preacher.
Mr. Preacher, I trust you have made it entirely clear to the immigrants that the same fate as befell these peaceful Arapaho will be theirs if they fail to keep up.
Yeah, well, I didn't put it quite that way, but they'll keep up. Be sure of that.
For all Preacher's assurances, by 9 o'clock in the morning, a considerable gap had developed between the Army freight wagons and the civilian train. But something about the specter of the Arapaho village must have influenced Isaac Warner. He became more aggressive in setting the pace for the cumbersome vehicles. Constantly, he urged greater speed. At times, his shouts to his mules could be heard far ahead by Preacher in the stillness of the high plains. By the noonan, it took only 10 minutes for the pilgrim train to catch up to the main body of troops. After stretching their legs and working the kinks from their backs, the civilians ate in the shade of the Conestogas and drank water to wash down the food. Warner actually had his charges ready to depart before the soldiers had completed their meal. To Preacher's surprise and satisfaction, he calculated they had made 15 miles shortly after he and Antoine Revier took their places scouting ahead of the column.
Oh, shit. I got a sinking sensation that gunfire ain't hunters out to bag fresh game for the evening meal.
The Blackfoot! They've come back! They're after the pilgrims!
It's moving! Yeah!
Warriors of the Iron Shield Society raced their ponies along the high-sided wagons of the immigrants. Filled with confidence by the medicine of Iron Shirt, they abandoned any of their usual caution. It came as a total surprise to two of them when young David Honeycutt leveled his side-by-side 10-gauge greener. Ahead of the Honeycutt wagon, rifles began to crackle as the well-armed Blackfoot poured a stream of lead into the stout vehicles of the immigrants. After several confused minutes, it appeared the hostiles were buying expensive victory. Eve Billings had been caught up in the middle of the fight, huddled low behind the 3-inch-thick oak sideboards of the Conestoga. She made good use of the Model 40 Bridesburg arsenal rifle and a shotgun. Hunkered beside her, Charlie industriously reloaded and handed the weapons to his mother as she fired at the engine.
Faster, Charlie! There's a whole lot of them out there!
Okay, Mom!
Charlie paused in the act of ramming a ball home in the Model 40 as a warrior leaped at the open front of their wagon. Swiftly, Charlie snatched up his .36-caliber squirrel rifle.
Mom! I shot him! Good boy!
Control came out of confusion as Preacher and his companions, accompanied by Captain Drayling and some of his company, suddenly bore down on the Blackfoot. The hostiles saw him coming, and those in the lead on both sides of the column reined in sharp. Several fired at the soldiers, while others reared their mounts and turned about. If you cared to run the gauntlet of the settlers again, the prospect of clashing with the soldiers held even less appeal.
Got a bottle up and twist the trailing.
Looks like it. I only hope those amateurs know enough to shoot at the Indians and not us.
We'll be pushing the Blackfoot hard. Like with those pilgrims won't even have time to shoot it anymore. Yeah!
Within a breath span, the mountain man and those with him clashed directly with the hesitant Blackfoot. Their faltering ceased abruptly when face to face with the white trooper. Unable to reload, the Blackfoot soon discovered themselves to be at a terrible disadvantage. Armed with a dozen immediate shots each from the big dragoon pistols, the soldiers blazed into the faces of the enemy. Preacher unlimbered his walking colt. A warrior came at him, tomahawk raised. Preacher turned to meet the threat. Short Tail and three other engines took the brunt of the dragoon charge on the opposite side from Preacher. Led by Three Sleeps Norris and Antoine Revier, the soldiers under the command of Lieutenant Bryce swept along the rear of the army column and caught the Blackfoot by surprise. Short Tail made to swing away, only to find his way blocked by a grinning man in buckskin.
Gonna run out on your friends, eh?
Three Sleeps sidestepped his mount as the Blackfoot fell dead at the side of his pony. He turned in the saddle and aimed at another brave. The big 60-caliber ball shattered the brave's shoulder joint, rendering his arm useless, and sending his pony in a frightened sideways dance, ending in a frantic dash away from the sounds and smells of battle. Two Moons witnessed the swift, short deaths of eight of his warriors. Quickly, the number of wounded mounted to 13 with another two dead. I couldn't believe this could be happening. What in the hell had happened to Iron Shirt's medicine? Had the shaman lied to him, deceived him as to how much power his rituals, dances, and Duncans in the river contained? A tortured half minute, fanatic belief changed to repudiation.
We have lost our medicine. Ride, braves!
Two Moons rallied his warriors and led the way from the shore in certain death and proud amongst them at the hands of the Bluecoats and their plainsfolk allies. Charlie Billings stood on the outside edge of the night camp, legs widespread, body bent forward and down. Tears of shame and misery coursed down his face. The misery came from his appalling sorrow over having taken a human life. The shame came from his reaction to what he had done. He had actually killed one Blackfoot, shot him right through the heart. He had wounded two others. One of them had spewed blood from his mouth as he fell away from the wagon. Charlie tensed as he heard the rustle of a footfall behind him.
Taking it hard, are you, son?
Don't look at me.
Oh, why not, Charlie? You think you're the first and only man who's been upset by killing someone?
Yeah, but I'll look like a sissy to everyone, especially you.
Look, you think I didn't cry my eyes out the first time I killed a man? And I was 4 years older than you.
You did? You were?
Preacher took a slow step forward, reached down, and put an arm around the boy's shoulders. Gently, he raised him to an upright position.
Yeah. Now, you might not believe it to see me now, but I went through everything you're experiencing. Trust me, it's never an easy thing. You saved your mother's life and your sister's. You should stand tall, Charlie. Be proud. You're a man now.
I am? I mean, I am. I really am. Oh, thank you, Preacher. I was so scared. I wanted to throw up all the time we were fighting. I wanted to run away and never hear a gun go off again.
Uh-huh. That's natural, son.
But I thought there wasn't that much difference between killing an animal or a man, that it would be easy.
Yeah. You just be thankful to God it wasn't easy for you. Those would find it like snapping their fingers are plumb crazy, and they're bound to meet a bad end.
Really?
Yeah, I ought to know. I brung more of them to that bad end than I care to count. Come on now. Your ma has supper ready.
After the meal, Eve confided in Preacher.
That was the worst thing that's ever happened to us. Those Indians didn't seem to care. They kept coming, no matter how many of us shot at them.
They believe themselves to be bulletproof. It's an Indian medicine thing.
Please don't misunderstand, Preacher. It's not that I fear for myself. It's only if some harm came to my children, I could not bear that. I've heard the stories, how the savages use children in horrid practices. They have their way with girls as young as 7. And as 8. Some I've been told even use boys in the same manner.
Well, I've never seen nor heard of such like happening to the younger children, and it's only a few tribes practice such vile things anyway. Mostly the younger ones, like Charlie and Anna, are used as slaves, or to take the place of a child who's died for one reason or another, especially if the kid shows some spirit. Well, hell, way Charlie fought off those warriors, he'd be a prize to them Blackfoot. One of them would adopt him, certain sure. Have him a loincloth and moccasins with a pony of his own and his hair in a braid in no time.
What a terrible fate! How could he possibly endure such a miserable life?
Well, now, you gotta understand, men are kings amongst the Indians, even when they're little kids. Most boys who are captured don't want to give it up when they got the chance. They got ponies of their own, which makes for how rich a body is amongst the savages. They learn how to use a bow, set snares, all kinds of things civilized folks have forgotten how to do.
That's not exactly reassuring, Preacher. It sounds like something my Charlie would love.
Well, I was only trying to show you that something else could be at hand in such an event.
And bless you for it. It's only that I'm so frightened for my children.
Although he still did not fully understand, Preacher took Eve protectively into his arms to calm her trembling. Instead of tensing, as did so many women in the arms of a powerful man, Eve melted into his chest. Her eyes still shone from the recently shed tears when she tilted her head upward to gaze into Preacher's eyes, which were alight with concern. At a loss for words of appreciation, Eve rose on tiptoe and placed her lips on those of Preacher. It started out as an expression of gratitude, but then it quickly changed into a long, hungry kiss that sent tendrils of fire through both of them. When it ended, both were breathless. Eve said not a word, only freed herself from Preacher's embrace and hurried into her wagon. His lips tingling, Preacher walked off to his blankets, thoroughly confused. That was the best kiss he'd shared in years. Camped alone for the first time in 6 months, Prager, Gross, and Riker experienced an overpowering sense of relief and safety. They paid little attention to the splendor of the Bighorn Mountains. What commanded their concentration glowed dully in the light of a coal oil lantern. Its main attraction centered on its size. Fully as large as a third knuckle of Prager's middle finger, the gold nugget lay on a square of black velvet that perfectly set off its splendor. Prager reached out and caressed its smooth, warm surface.
It weighs a bit over 6 ounces.
Avarice glowed in the eyes of Morton Gross.
Where did it come from?
The area I told you about before. It came out of the Lolo Range of the Rocky Mountains near the Continental Divide. And there are more like this. Lots more.
A sudden rustle at the tent flap drew their attention, and Quentin Prager quickly concealed the nugget. Blake Sowers, dressed in Blackfoot garb, entered.
The men are ready to ride out, Mr. Prager.
Where this time?
There's a clutch of psalm shouters nestled down to the east of here, near the headwaters of the Tongue River. I figure we ought to pay him a visit. We'll leave enough living behind to swear it was Blackfoot who did it.
Prager beamed, and he came to his boots to shake the hand of Sowers.
Excellent. Just make sure that no one can identify you as white men. That would be a disaster.
Brother Frankel couldn't sleep. He sat alone by the dying embers of the central fire in the circle of wagons. Behind him, the mules and horses of their wagon train milled about in drowsy stubbornness. Just like him, none of them wanted to lie down and sleep. A yellow-orange streak suddenly arced through the blackness of night.
Huh? A shooting star?
3 more arcs of fire fluttered through the air. 2 struck a wagon's side and the canvas top burst into flame.
Dear Lord, protect us! Indians! We're under attack!
Suddenly, a steady stream of war-painted savages flowed into the unprotected center. One aimed his rifle at Brother Franklin. The terrified men and women poured from their rolling homes to spill onto the ground. There they cowered in the dirt, quaking in absolute terror. They died that way, cut down by arrow, tomahawk, or bullet. The children peered out over tailgates, only to have their brains dashed out by war clubs and already bloody tomahawks. Within minutes, the slaughter was over, and every one of the pilgrims was dead. The gang of disguised, murderous whites fired all the remaining wagons, took the livestock, and rode off. Blake Sowers made certain that ample items of Blackfoot manufacture were left to be discovered by those who found the remains of the unfortunate missionaries. Lieutenant Colonel Danvers counseled with Preacher and the mountain men at noon the next day.
We are to turn northward after our midday meal and head for the Powder River. Our objective, as I have explained before, is where the Powder cuts through the lower foothills of the Bighorn Mountains.
Danvers' finger pointed to a spot on the crude map.
Right here. There's supposed to be an ideal bluff on which to build the fort.
Preacher knew the country well. He studied the indicated location, gave it several moments' thought, then shook his head.
Nope, I wouldn't recommend it. Trees are scarce in those parts.
Why, I've been assured the trees grow right down into the bluff.
That may well be true, but after you build your fort, you'd be required to go outside every day or so for firewood. And another thing, from what this map shows, that bluff is exposed to higher ground on all but one side. Well, one side and part of a second. A fella could fire right down into the fort. Now, that won't matter much for a while, but consider this. What happens when the Cheyenne get their hands on some of those new rifles like we took off the Blackfoot the other day?
None of this is your concern. Your job is to see we get there.
That's true. I'm only pointing out some things. Like, for instance, unless you don't want to dig a well down several hundred feet. You'll have to take the livestock out daily to water at this little creek that feeds into the powder, and haul more water to have something for the people.
That's nonsense. You don't know what you're talking about. I've been given assurances from the United States Survey Office, backed up by the highest authority. They have assured me there is ample wood for lumber, and for cooking and heating, lush grass and easy access to water.
Easy as long as you don't rile the Indians. That's Cheyenne country, and the land of their cousins, the Sioux. Now, they don't look on owning land the same way we do, but they're mighty territorial just the same. And I ain't even mentioned the Crow and the Blackfoot.
Savages are savages. We will be prepared to take them in stride. Let it suffice that this is the location chosen at the War Department, and it is where we will build.
All through the next day, Preacher and his companions found plentiful Injun signs. It took little time to come to the obvious conclusion. They were being watched. Three Crows walked and returned to the column to report the same.
What do we do now?
Make real certain every lump you see on the ground. Some of them might breathe. Also, I'd have my weapons at hand every minute. Never can tell.
My thoughts exactly. We already keep watch on dust clouds in the sky.
Good man, Three Crows. With you as our eyes out front, we don't need to worry.
For the rest of the afternoon, Preacher rode along in higher spirits, though not oblivious to the plentiful sign of a Blackfoot presence. After camp had been made for the night, Preacher walked away from the bustle of soldiers and pilgrims to find a little solitude for himself. He had pulled a twisted black dry-cured cigar from the pocket of his buckskin shirt when he looked up and spotted three Cheyenne warriors on horseback. Silhouetted against the ruddy ball of the setting sun, they sat at ease, one bent forward with a hand on his bare knee. Preacher's eyes narrowed as he studied them. Each wore two feathers at the back of his head, the frizzed and fox-fur-trimmed tips pointing upward, a sure sign of being on the war trail. Slight motions of the watching Injuns revealed that they both carried lances. Little Charlie Billings stood there, eyes wide with shock at the swift movement of Preacher. He swallowed hard and rubbed a bare foot against his overalls leg.
It's only me.
Sorry, Charlie. Something out there spooked me.
For the first time, the boy looked out beyond Preacher. His eyes went round and white, and his jaw clapped shut. Before he could speak, he had to swallow hard.
Are those Injuns Blackfoot?
Nope, Charlie. They Cheyenne. Done up for war. There's no reason to keep the truth from you. You're man enough to handle it, and I trust man enough not to spread alarm amongst the rest of your pilgrims.
Yes, sir.
Good. You do me proud. Now, Charlie, what'd you come out here for?
Mom told me to ask you to come to supper tonight. But now, with those Injuns out there, I don't suppose he can.
Well, I don't see why not. Only if I were you, Charlie, I'd sleep with your shotgun beside you tonight.
Dressed in white men's suits, Quentin Prager, Morton Gross, and Aaron Riker sashayed into one of the saloons that graced a large, prosperous trading post on the South Fork of the Powder River. All three paid token deference to current custom with the wide, brightly colored sashes around their middles. That the red one worn by Prager, the green cloth strip on Gross, and the electric blue chosen by Riker concealed at least one pistol each was a given. Several roughly dressed individuals at the bar gave them cold, inhospitable stares as they took a table to one side. Morton Gross stared right back at the men.
Friendly sort, aren't they? 2 months back, they fell all over us, offering to buy the drinks.
We were dressed like they are then. I doubt if they recognize us, let alone remember how hard they tried to be hired on to work with Sours.
A huge man with greasy, long, black, curly hair and a matching mustache pushed himself away from the bar and turned in their direction. He had thick, rubbery lips that shone wetly, and made it obvious that he had been drinking heavily. Waving a huge ham hand, he encompassed the well-dressed trio.
Hey, fancy boys. This here's a man's bar. They call me Dandy Spencer. And I want you to know we don't allow no prissy Eastern folk to come in and spoil the...
Try ambience, my good man.
I ain't your good man, nor any others. I'm my own man and proud of it. Talk like that could get your head busted out here.
Are you challenging me, Mr. Spencer?
You goddamn right.
Well, then, since I'm the challenged one, I have the choice of weapon, time, and place, right?
A puzzled frown creased the bull head of Dandy Spencer.
That's a mighty useless way to go about it, you ask me. Around these parts, we just open the dance and set the clawing. You ain't got sand for that. Turn tail and light out of here.
Oh, I can understand the customs of such drunken louts as yourself without explanation, Mr. Spencer. My point is that I wish to make clear the terms of our duel.
Duel? What duel?
Why, the one you just challenged me to.
I didn't challenge you to no duel. I said I wanted to rip your goddamn head off.
Good enough. Same thing. You want to fight with me. I have agreed. Thus, the choice of weapons, place, and time are mine. It's only fair.
I never fought fair in my life.
Prager appeared unfazed. The cold glint in his eyes betrayed to all but the dullest, which unfortunately included Dandy Spencer, the hidden strength he possessed.
I can believe that. You want to fight? I accept. Now, I pick how we fight and when. I see you have a pistol, so I choose pistols. The place? Right here. At the time, now.
The hot lead sheared through the man's right elbow joint. Dandy, whom fate had decreed to be left-handed, completed his draw in spite of the pain that flared up his opposite arm. Gritting his teeth, he swung the muzzle in the direction of Prager. Spencer's ball went wide. Quentin Prager let his empty pistol drop to the tabletop and whipped out a second deadly derringer. Prager put the ball between two ribs, low on the left side of the chest of Dandy Spencer. Dandy's coach gun hit the floor, and he clumsily groped for another one.
This one's a bit hard to finish.
Prager's associates came to their booths and drew pistols to cover the rest of the room. Prager took a third pistol from partway around the sash and brought up the barrel. Dandy Spencer went slack-legged and flopped forward over the table occupied by the conspirators. Prager returned his pistols to their proper place.
Barkeep, I need someone to remove this trash, and I'll stand around for the house.
Dawn found everything safe and sound. Cheyenne did not attack. Accordingly, the column set out again on what could best be described as an uneventful journey. So confident had Lieutenant Colonel Danvers become that he urged Preacher to ride at his side. Now, Preacher found that not at all a pleasant prospect.
Those Cheyenne you spied did not attack us. They sat quietly and watched us without any show of hostile intent. Perhaps they were curious. With their childlike minds, that could be expected.
Them childlike minds you refer to have planned and carried off some of the slickest ambushes you'll ever see. As for their hostile intent, Colonel, them braves had their feathers upright. Those feathers are a symbol of their valor. They're fixed in a beaded disc and are worn in different directions for different reasons. Down toward their left shoulder, that means they're looking for no trouble. Down to the right, since they're looking to do some courting. Up, like they had them, means they're ready for war. The biggest mistake most whites make about Injuns is, since they live different from us, they think they ain't got no smarts. Don't fall into that hole, Colonel. It could be the death of you.
Believe me, I've learned that lesson already. I still can't find a reason why the Pawnee were so hot-headed.
Because the Blackfoot and Cheyenne are worked up. There's war talk and raids all over the high plains. For all their lack of modern communication, word gets around the tribes mighty fast.
Our purpose in being here is to induce a calming effect.
Uh-huh. It seems to me we're doing just the opposite. Preacher couldn't fathom the meaning behind the enigmatic smile with which Danvers silently answered him. But he soon found himself with a lot more to occupy him. By mid-morning, the column had made 10 miles, a new record since adopting the abandoned wagon train. It had been accomplished with no end of grumbling by the pilgrims. When Gus Beecher cantered up to the head of the column for the third time, Preacher knew he was in for more of it.
Blast and damn, this pace is killing my mules! You have to slow down!
Well, the colonel, of course, would not deign to address whining civilians. Instead, he cut his eyes to Preacher in a silent order to the mountain man to handle the situation.
We don't have to do anything of the sort. I can't see a reason to have to explain this again, Gus, but here goes. This is a military expedition. It is under orders to get along the trail at the convenience of the Dragoon Battalion Commander. That'd be Colonel Danvers here. Now, he says we gotta make better time, so we better make better time. You may not like it, I may not like it, but we ain't got any say in it. Now, I told you before, Mr. Beecher, to get rid of some of that heavy load yourself or do it at gunpoint. Now, if I was you, I'd tail it back to that wagon and start heaving heavy things out as you go.
You can't do this to me! I'll protest!
To whom?
Why, to the War Department!
Go right ahead. I estimate the next post will run through here in about 50 years.
Well, I'll hold a meeting! Circulate a petition!
Oh, you do that, Mr. Beecher. I love to read petitions.
Beecher turned away. He had ridden halfway down the column when suddenly, a force of over 100 Blackfoot Braves in war paint rushed down on the cavalcade from one side and the rear. Nearly every engine had a rifle, which they fired at once with much enthusiasm, albeit little accuracy. The troops immediately responded with a furious volley.
Kneel on! Volley by companies! Company A, take aim! Fire! Reload! Company B, take aim! Fire!
Suddenly, the Blackfoot broke off the attack and rode away.
Reload, men! They'll be coming back! Get ready!
The respite only lasted a few minutes. The discipline drilled into him by Iron Shirt and his closest followers dissolved when six warriors toppled from their saddles in the volley. The Braves turned their charge into a scramble for individual arms. It became a pigeon shoot for even the most inept dragoons, a source of deep disillusionment for the Blackfoot, as one after another of the Braves fell dead from their ponies.
Lieutenant Colonel, it might be none of my damn business, but I wonder why the hell you didn't put out flankers today.
You're right. It's none of your business. The truth is, I grew overconfident. Are these some of your friendly Cheyenne?
Nope, Blackfoot. That prophet of theirs must have got them all riled up.
That had better not be the case.
Dangerously close to the wagons, within 25 yards, the Blackfoot lost their nerve at last. They scattered up a red-orange slope like so many coppery leaves in a whirlwind. Bullets followed, though only preachers, his companions, and BSM Muldoon scored in flesh.
First and second platoon, C Company, pursue the enemy. Lieutenant Bryce in command. Move them out.
I wouldn't.
Preacher made to dissuade the Dragoon commander, then cut off his words at sight of the wild light in the colonel's eyes.
Stubborn damn idiot. Let him learn the hard way.
With a full platoon at left and right, Lieutenant Bryce led the charge from the middle. The big, powerful Dragoon horses churned up the rise and hesitated only a fraction of a second before plunging down the reverse slope. Preacher did not wait for the realization to come over Danvers. He looked at Captain Drayling.
Come on, Captain. Bring the rest of your company. Let's go get your men back. Yeah!
With Danvers sputtering alone at the head of the column, the entire Dragoon battalion broke ranks and charged over the rise. In the lead, Preacher took encouragement from the continued crackle and exchange. It had to be a small ambush to keep the troops alive so long. Preacher and the two remaining platoon of C Company slammed into the surprised Blackfoot war party before the engines could react. Preacher's Hawkins bucked in his grip. Preacher shot a Blackfoot high in the chest on the center line. Knocked to one side, the warrior disappeared under the hooves of his companion horse. With the Hawkins dry, Preacher shoved it into the scabbard and drew his Colt. The remaining engine swung away from the onslaught of so many soldiers and rode swiftly out of range. Dead soldiers and engines littered the ground, staining it red with blood and gore. Danvers cantered up, his saber drawn.
I demand to know who ordered that charge.
Drayling cut his eyes to Preacher, who winked at him.
I don't know, sir. I didn't. It sort of just happened.
We'll not go after them. Oh, and Mr. Preacher, your point about ambushes is noted and stored for future reference.
Talking Cloud was decidedly unhappy. The medicine of Iron Shirt had deserted them. Of the number of warriors with which he had started, 117, he had 25 men killed and
35 wounded. He directed the survivors to the big war camp to the west. There, he went directly to Three Horses, who listened to his complaints with obvious indifference. That only served to inflame Talking Cloud more.
How could Iron Shirt's medicine have failed us?
They did not believe enough in the medicine, or they were not purified enough.
You did not hear me. 5 hands killed and 7 hands wounded. Not that many could be impure or doubtful at the same time. This means we will not be able to guard our village from the Shoshone this winter.
Then take your people to the Bighorn Mountains.
Not satisfied in the least with that suggestion, Talking Cloud went in search of Iron Shirt. He found the visionary medicine man in the process of initiating a group of 25 Cheyenne. Talking Cloud viewed the proceedings with far less conviction than before. When the rite had been concluded and the male shirt exposed, Talking Cloud took Iron Shirt aside. He wasted no time on diplomacy.
Why is it that your rebirth in water and the Gauntlet of Coals did not purify the warriors killed so far?
You have had men die?
5 hands in 1 battle. They went down like aspen in a whirlwind.
Another Strongheart ceremony is needed. Gather your men, and we can do it while the coals are still hot. Then you will see.
That evening, when the nervousness and strain of the attack had eased, Eve Billings sought out Preacher, who sat with his companions, a plate of fatback and beans in his hands. She looked at the concoction with unease and forced a smile.
You didn't come to supper tonight. I know Charlie relayed my invitation.
Yeah, that he did, and nope, I did not. Too much good cooking makes a man soft.
Preacher set the tin plate aside and pinched his flat, hard abdomen.
Why, I reckon I've gained 5 pounds sponging off your generosity. Thought I'd take a day or two away from the delicious table you lay so as not to make a habit of it.
Smiling, Eve reached out a coaxing hand.
I wouldn't mind if you made a habit of it. Matter of fact, I'd like that a lot.
Preacher roused himself. He joined Eve and they ambled off toward the southern edge of the large encampment. There, they found the peaceful vista of a moonlit, rolling sea of grass. It stretched out before them to the south, east, and west.
It's so tranquil out there. You'd never know those savages are lurking out in the dark.
I don't reckon they are. They were Blackfoot. That means they were loaded up with that hokum of Iron Shirts. When we killed a passel of them, hell, they had to think the medicine failed them. They'd get spooked at that, so it's likely they'll go off and lick their wounds.
I hope you're right. Preacher, about the other night, the kiss, it was brazen of me, but I think it was wonderful.
She did a step turn and faced Preacher, her arms wide. He paused only a moment before he reached out and drew her into a firm embrace. Iron Shirt stood before his lodge and scowled as Quentin Prager and his 2 associates rode through the rings of lodges that made up this large encampment of Blackfoot. Cheyenne and some Pawnee had left their country to the east to join in the battle against all whites. The Sioux would come to him soon. He believed that in his heart, which intensified his displeasure at the return of these renegade white men.
They should stay away. We could make them stay away.
The time is not right to do away with them as yet, my friend. We must get the last of the weapons they promise. The powder and balls, the caps. Without them, we cannot win.
I heard about Talking Cloud. Will he stay after the new ritual?
I do not know. If not, we lose 8 hands of warriors. It would weaken us.
The Cheyenne and the Sioux?
They'll come. Not all as we had hoped. Cloud Blanket has taken his people away.
If Talking Cloud leaves us, then we will be too weak for the final battle.
No, we will not. We will drive the whites past the Big Water River. My spirit guide tells me this is true.
Would that he told me the same.
You doubt my vision?
No. Only I think you should fast and visit with your spirit guide again. We do not know him. We have not heard him speak. Our strength, our faith, comes from you.
Perhaps you are right. I will think on it. But first, we must impress on our white friends the need for more rifles.
After another three long, satisfying, uneventful days, Preacher guided his fledgling soldiers to the spot selected by Lieutenant Colonel Danvers. It was situated on a nice promontory overlooking a deep valley and the ringing peaks of the Bighorn Mountains. Tents went up with many joyful sounds of relief. Even in their permanent situation, Preacher noted, the civilians kept to themselves, erecting their spare wagon covers for tents. A surveying crew set up and began to lay out the fort. Gus Beecher started to assemble his smithy, leaving his family shelter to his wife and daughters to prepare. With the only direct, easy approach up a draw and along the wide slope and finger of land that led to the site, the main gate would be there, also the only stockade. That bothered Preacher. He left the details of their camp to Antoine Revier and went in search of Danvers. He found the commander with the surveyors, in shirt sleeves, gesturing with wide, emphatic swings of his arms. When Danvers completed his vehement discussion, he turned to find Preacher patiently waiting.
Pardon me, Colonel. I figured now was the time to remind you of a few things. You may want to put up a stockade all around this place. Look there over my shoulder. It's a mighty high peak back there. I know it's kind of steep, but even so, hostiles could come sweeping right down there and behind this wall. That'd trap you folks. And then there's the water. This spine is pure granite. I don't think you can dig a well. More likely, a cistern would be the best thing you can do. Big pit, blasted out of the rock and covered over. That could give you a good supply of rainwater and snow melt. That won't last a year round, though. And as for trees to make your buildings and your stockade, you can see that outside that little stand over there, the nearest are out of range of your best riflemen. They're not going to have any protection while they're cutting. Lieutenant Colonel Danvers gave Preacher a long, cool look up and down as though inspecting a tramp discovered in his backyard.
Your job with the Army is ended, Mr. Preacher. I have these problems in mind and can handle them adequately. If you so choose, you may leave.
Is that your final word on this?
It most certainly is. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Well then, by God, I just might pull out after all. Me and my friends.
Oh, but there is work for them if they wish to remain.
I think I can answer for them. Thanks, but no thanks.
Preacher felt duty-bound to explain his decision to Eve Billings. He went to her and stood, hat in one hand, and informed her of his decision to leave the next day for his favorite country in the Colorado Rockies. Eve's eyes went wide when she understood what his rambling phrases meant.
Oh, but you can't. You've helped us so much. We would have never made it without you, dear, dear Preacher.
Colonel don't want me around anymore. He as much as told me to pack my saddlebags and haul out of here.
You are your own man, aren't you? He is bound to protect civilians within the range of the fort. You could join us, and he would be obliged to put up with you.
No, Eve, I couldn't do that.
Oh, and why not?
Eve spun on one heel.
Charlie? Charlie Billings, come here at once.
Yeah, Ma?
Go find Mr. Warner and Mr. Tate. Bring them here. Mr. Beecher, too. Tell them it is very important.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, Eve, there's no call to cause a fuss.
It's not a fuss I'm figuring on. You must be convinced that we need you here to teach us things to help us survive when we set up for Oregon country again.
Oh, now, shoot, anybody can do that for you. Don't have to be me. The way I figure it, I got about enough time to get back to the High Lonesome, stock up on supplies, and make it to my wintering place and settle in.
Are you always this selfish? Don't you ever consider giving others a helping hand?
No, I always had to make do for myself, and I've observed that those folks who get ahead in this world have done the same.
Why, that's awful. It's so unchristian.
Yeah, well, I don't ever recall laying claim to being a Christian.
For shame, Preacher! Are we having our first fight, Preacher?
By dang, I think you're right. Looks like that's just what it is.
Preacher reached out for Eve and put one arm on her shoulder. They remained in a chaste semi-embrace when the wagon train leader stormed up. Beat-faced, Gus Beecher made the first complaint.
What's so all-fired important to take me away from settling in? I've my smithy to finish. We've a cave to dig and sod walls to put up, a sod roof to add.
Then Gus cocked a gimlet eye at Eve Billings.
Or is it that the widow Billings has chosen now to announce her engagement?
What stuff and nonsense, Gus Beecher. Preacher is talking about leaving.
Eve went on to relate what he had told her of the confrontation with Lieutenant Colonel Danvers and his decision to leave. That changed the tone of the men, except for Gus Beecher, of course.
He can go any time he wants, for all I care.
Preacher, you can't leave us like this. There's so much we need to learn. And how can we ever get along with Colonel Danvers?
I reckon pretty much like porcupines make love. Real careful.
You'll leave us helpless. Look at all you've done so far. We've learned how to make better time, how to effectively fight Indians, better ways to cook for the noon, and so many things. How to better track and take down game, what to avoid on the trail. Such things make you a gold mine to us. Please, at least take a day or two to think it over. We haven't much left, but we can pay you for your advice. Won't you at least give it fair consideration, Preacher?
I'll think on it some. No promises, mind, but I'll let you know.
By mid-morning the next day, the surveyor and his crew had driven stakes to set out the dimensions of the stockade and its headquarters, also the corral and two outbuildings. Favorably noting this rapid progress, Lieutenant Colonel Danvers ordered felling crews to be detailed to cut down trees in the thick stands of pine down near the base of the finger-like promontory. Hearing of this, Gus Beecher came to the colonel and, toadying up as was his wont, offered his services to forge hinges for the gate, along with bolts, spikes, and other iron products as needed, at a reasonable price, of course. To his credit, Danvers let his face show his distaste for the man, though he did hire him on a by-the-job basis. The colonel learned of three men among the civilians who had sawmill experience. He interviewed them, and satisfied, hired them at once.
You are to inspect, set up, and operate the portable saw that accompanied us from Jefferson Barracks. I expect a preliminary report by this afternoon.
Shortly after 2 o'clock that afternoon, the three sawyers came back to Danvers. The eldest, Tom Quigley, who had been a foreman, revealed the results of their studies.
The blade made it through nice as can be. Same from other parts. The belts could stand a good oiling and they'd be supple again. There's only one problem.
What is that?
How are we going to power the saw? That blade has to be moving a fair clip to cut through wood, especially green wood.
I was given to understand that everything necessary had been included. Surely you've overlooked something.
Nope, not a blessed thing. Oh, it's all there, disassembled and the parts numbered. You see, Colonel, this mill was designed to be run by a water wheel.
There was no wheel with the saw parts.
Nope, we have to build it. The metal fittings are all there.
How does it operate?
Well, Colonel, there's this big old flywheel that attaches to the spline of the water wheel and a little one that goes on the shaft of the saw blade. Problem is, we gotta have a water source to use it.
Damn! I am constantly beset with obstacles. Why is that, do you suppose, Mr. Quigley?
I wouldn't rightly know, sir, being I ain't in the Army. But from those I know what have been, it seems that's the way of it, Colonel. If it ain't one thing going wrong, it's another.
Quite right, Quigley. Quite right indeed. That has been the bane of my existence since I attended the military academy. Not once has anyone put it so succinctly. But that's not my immediate problem. Why did these idiots in the Quartermaster Corps provide us with a water-powered sawmill when we were coming into this godforsaken country?
It's mountainous, sir. Maybe they thought you'd find a waterfall, which would be dandy for this kind of mill.
Those fools have never seen beyond the west bank of the Potomac, let alone the real west. Can you convert it to a treadmill?
Not easily, nor likely, Colonel. Best bet is we dam up that creek down below to build pressure and put the mill wheel in the spillway.
Can that be done?
Easy as can be. Your engineering officer and someone with knowledge of artillery could do the figures and draw up what's needed. The surveyors could lay it out.
Then get to it. I'll assign the men you asked for to your supervision. We need that mill operative as soon as possible. By all means, long before winter.
Preacher decided to take one more look around at the operation Danvers had put in motion before making his final decision. What he saw through his spyglass only convinced him further of the folly of the entire project. The fellers had moved a good 3/4 of a mile from the site of the fort. Well out of range of cover and fire, the only protection they had came from a half a dozen dragoons assigned to them. Already the detail assigned to limbing the logs and dragging them down to the area of the stockade had run into trouble. Dragoon horses, unaccustomed to working in harness, rebelled against the strangeness of heavy loads that pulled against their necks. They clashed into one another, reared, and occasionally balked. For most of their journey, they remained out of rifle range from the fort as well. Preacher found Captain Drayling watching the neophyte lumberjacks through field glasses.
Just betwixt you and me, Edward, this is one hell of a mistake. Those fellas out there are as exposed as a baby's bare bottom on birthing day. You're all near 1,000 miles from any other soldiers, just about as far from any white man. Supply's gonna be difficult, impossible in winter, and the colonel's plans for water are non-existent, or plumb silly at best.
Are you wound down now, my friend? For all the good it'll do, I agree with you absolutely. Putting a fort here, on this impossible plateau, in the middle of Indian country, is what I call downright suicidal.
I done told the colonel he'd be wise to make a large cistern in the middle of the fort area. That'd give you a reliable supply most of the year. If you ran a stockade around the whole place, it'd even be safe to draw water during an attack.
The cistern would work? Tell me about it.
For the next half hour, Preacher enlarged his idea, although in conclusion, he returned to his main theme.
Smartest thing to do would be to get clear the hell away from here and set up someplace else.
Later in the afternoon, Preacher had opportunity to point out to Lieutenant Colonel Danvers all he had discussed with Captain Drayling. The colonel barely suppressed his irritation.
All right, Mr. Preacher, I'll agree with you on one point. I have been studying the approach routes to the site. I'm ordering other palisades to be erected along the south and west faces. I've come to the conclusion that without them, we are entirely too exposed. I'm certain that the sheer walls to the east side will take care of any threat from that direction.
I'd give that a second thought too, Colonel, because even if the walls are sheer, including being too steep to climb safely, unless they're completely concave, there won't be no such word as can't in the heads of the engines fixing on climbing them.
I'll consider it, but it won't be at the top of my list of priorities.
Well, mayhap it better be, Colonel, because I'm sure it's on their minds.
With a slow movement, Preacher raised his arm and, like the specter of doom, pointed a long finger at the figures of some 40 mounted Cheyenne and 25 Lakota warriors, watching in ominous silence from the hilltops in the near distance. Eve Billings could not believe the emotions that surged through her. At one moment, a girlish giddiness flooded her. The next, she sank into deep shame that she could imagine such a thing so soon after poor Howard's death. Then she'd find herself awash with gloomy despair that she would never have what she so dearly wanted. Then euphoria surged again. She'd hum old ballads, put a dance step in her walk, a sparkle in her eyes, and a silly smile on her lips. Abruptly, she broke off her self-examination to give Charlie's shoulder a hard squeeze.
Ouch! Charlie, sit still. I'm trying to cut your hair evenly all around.
I don't want my hair cut. I want to grow it long so I can braid it.
Why, Charlie, whatever for?
Indian boys have their hair braided.
Charles Ryan Billings, your hair is as auburn as mine and your complexion is fair. You are not an Indian boy.
I want to be.
What put that notion in your head, son?
I've been thinking. Indian boys get to ride and hunt and fish and swim whenever they want to. Preacher's told me so. Preacher also told me that Indian boys' folks don't spank them.
Have you done something that you think you might be spanked for?
No. Yes. I don't know.
Do you want to tell me about it?
I can't. I promised. It's a secret between him and me.
Who? Preacher?
No, Mom. Not him. Someone secret.
One hand on her hip, Eve shook her head in resignation. She'd learn about it sooner or later. She knew that with a mother's certainty. A week went by with the logging detail required to go farther from the rudimentary fort each day. The present party of 18, 12 loggers and 6 guards, had only ridden out of sight when Preacher heard the muffled pop of gunfire. Quickly, he made his way across the crudely marked out parade ground. He went directly to the large tent located in the center of an area that would become the future headquarters. Preacher brushed past the sentries and strode straight to the desk behind which sat Lieutenant Colonel Danvers.
I'm so sorry to bother you, Colonel, but from the sound of it, your loggers are getting attacked.
What? That's impossible. They have an escort.
I don't think that means much to a half a hundred Cheyenne.
Before Danvers could work up a reply, a mounted man thundered up to the tent.
Colonel! Colonel! We're under attack! Injuns are swarming all over us!
Here?
The wild-eyed Peters, his face slicked with fear, sweat, and mottled with dust, burst through the flap.
It's a detail, sir! There must be 100 Injuns!
Danvers turned to the commander of Company A.
Borden, assemble your men. Form a relief column. Extra cartridges for all. Be ready to ride in 5 minutes. Mr. Preacher, will you scout?
Oh, I reckon so, Colonel.
Dust and powder smoke boiled up from beyond the nearest swell on the crest of the Bighorn Mountains. Preacher ignored the rough trail already cut into the soil and took the most direct route. Streaming behind him in a column of twos, the dragoons pounded hard over the ground. 7 minutes later, they came upon the rear of the left flank of a two-sided Cheyenne attack. Startled Injuns in the grass turned at the sound of pounding hooves. Commander Borden was quick to reply to the threat.
Echelon left and right, draw carbines, aim, fire!
Four warriors went down before a scythe of lead. Three others took wounds and disabled them.
Pull it on, boy!
Preacher quickly cut his way towards the stalled wagons, his hand filled now with a Walker Colt. A warrior lunged from the back of his pony towards Preacher. With the crushing force of the dragoons rushing down on him, the 43 remaining Cheyenne warriors lost interest in their no longer easy prey. They abandoned the attack and raced through the waving grass to disappear down a draw.
Strange. I could have swore I seen some Blackfoot amongst them Cheyenne. Those two tribes have been enemies for hundreds of years. I can believe the Cheyenne might listen to Iron Church crap, but I'd be hard-pressed to figure he could pull together a lasting alliance. I'm pretty sure I saw a Blackfoot pattern on a shield and in the decoration of a feathered lance.
Once back at the fort, Preacher stormed directly into the headquarters tent to confront Lieutenant Colonel Danvers.
Colonel, according to what those fellers in Washington City writ to me, I was to advise you in all matters regarding the frontier, including Injun fighting techniques and the habits of the tribes. Now, for the last 2 months, that is what I've been trying to do. Only you seem determined to ignore what I say. Now, unlike me, these boys has got to do as you say. What I wonder is why you remain so blind to the formidable danger everyone is being subjected to. Don't you care? My point is, we have hostiles where there weren't none when I left for Jefferson Barracks. That could be exceedingly costly to the lives of these young men.
They volunteered for the army, every man jack of them. As for my lack of surprise, I must say that I didn't expect the savages to come down and greet my troops with open arms. I learned that from you on the way out here. It is something we all have to take in stride or get out of the game. Now, is there anything of importance you have for me?
I want to scout that raiding party, see where they're going and what they're up to.
That's quite all right with me. Be ready to make a complete report when you return, and leave at least one of the other scouts for duties around the fort.
An hour later, Preacher and Antoine Revier left the fledgling fort. They traveled light, with only what their saddle and possibles bags could carry. Once clear of the finger of land and out of sight of the fort, the wilderness swallowed them. To some, the silence and vastness would be intimidating. Not so the mountain men. For Preacher and Antoine, a welcome blanket of tranquility settled over them. They picked up the trail of the fleeing Cheyenne easily and began to follow it, conscious that they were being watched every inch of the way. Preacher had an intense itching sensation between his shoulder blades. Preacher and Antoine trailed along behind the war party at a leisurely pace. That way it took 2 days to catch up. Preacher saw the first sign of the hostiles. The point and part of the shaft of a feather-decorated lance seemed to float on the horizon. Within a few strides, a mop of black braided hair rose into view. A single eagle feather protruded upward from the back of the head. Preacher made a sign to Antoine Revier, and they reined in their mounts. Preacher cupped his chin in one hand.
We found them right enough. Now what are we going to do with them?
I figured you'd have got an idea or two up your sleeve, Preacher. Me? I could use a nice snooze between now and full dark.
Right. We eat now and wait till nightfall to move in closer.
After staking out their horses to graze, the two mountain men leaned against their saddles, which they had propped against the thick trunk of an ancient oak. They gnawed on strips of softened jerky, Cold biscuits and a pot of beans, provided by Eve Billings, filled out the meal. Preacher pointed in the direction taken by the Cheyenne.
Them fellas ain't gonna throw out a welcome blanket for us, so I figure we need to get in real close tonight and find out what they're talking about. Get the lay of the land, so to speak. Then we can decide what to do.
Suits me. I ain't exactly anxious to go mix in with them unawares. Hey, preacher, how's it feel to be away from those soldier boys and on your own again?
Oh, shit, I ain't felt this good in 3 months. I just about got the stink of white folks out my lungs. Why is it there's so many of them have such an aversion to keeping clean? Good Injun nose could smell them coming a quarter mile away.
Can you imagine the mess it would make in a creek if all them soldiers and the pilgrims took a bath every night?
Oh, never thought of it that way before. Maybe you're right. All that soap and stench floating downstream would tell an Injun just where to look. Well, no matter. It's good to be out here. I'm gonna pull me a tomcat and catch a few winks.
Only the pale, frosty light of the stars broke up the black blanket of a moonless night later on when Preacher and Antoine fastened their horses to ground anchors and eeled through the tough, wiry grass to within 10 yards of the Cheyenne camp. Low, small lodges had been set in a semicircle around a large central fire. Preacher studied the rows of seated men. Sure enough, he was right pleased to note, there was more than one Blackfoot among the Cheyenne. One of them stood before the assembly.
When Iron Shirt and our people join you and your cousins, the Lakota, it will be easy to kill all the white men on the bluff. Then we will sweep across the plains with rifle and firebrand and drive the rest out of the country of our brothers forever. In 2 suns' time, all of the Iron Shield Society will join us here, and a massacre will soon follow. Those who died in the attack on the wagons did not have strong enough faith in the medicine of Iron Shirt. Look about you. The faces you see are of those who, like you, believed. With strong hearts like yours, we cannot fail.
Preacher had heard enough. He tugged at the sleeve of Revier's hunting shirt and motioned for him to draw back. Cautiously, they began to move away from the Cheyenne camp. They made it halfway to their horses without incident. Then, as he crawled past a large sage bush, Preacher found himself looking at 5 pair of coppery knees. Slowly, he raised his gaze to take in the warriors, all of whom competently held modern rifles, pointed competently at him. He froze.
Preacher, damn me, but I think we are caught.
Damn me, but I think you're right.
Suddenly, blackness engulfed Preacher's entire world.